Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
That lovely introduction and this nice sun coming in, I just kind of feel like taking a nap. But I'll try to endeavor to do what I intended to do. Can you hear me okay if I'm talking like this?
Yeah.
It's clever to have a microphone. We don't have one. Because I always feel like people will be able to hear. It's about the same size room as this, but actually probably people can hear. So this is a little bit like, you know, selling water by the river or something, but I thought I would talk a little about the koan literature. Is supposed to be like your domain. But there's all kinds of funny things that have grown up over the years and decades and countries and centuries, and one of them is a kind of a false dichotomy that that the Rinzai school is super into koans and does them only a certain very intense, single-pointed way of study, and the Soto guys are sort of too spaced out for them to ever think of doing that. Too busy silently illuminating their minds. But actually, this is the kind of holy writ of Zen, of all schools, and it's a very strange literature to our eyes, and probably to the eyes of the Chinese and Japanese students who are studying it as well, although we have some extra layers of translation and culture in between us and these short stories. And so I thought I'd bring up a story as an example of the stories in the Gateless Gate koan collection, one of three most famous collected koans, koan collections. Probably the most famous, I know Kushin Sun has talked about before, which is called the Gateless Gate or the Mumon Koan. So this is one of the other ones. This is like the number two one in Japanese Zen.
You said Gateless Gate, but you meant...
Blue Cliff Record. I said the wrong thing, yeah. This is from the Blue Cliff Record, thanks, yeah. The Hekigan Roku in Japanese, or Pi Yu Lin, or something like that in Chinese. So anyway, let me read you the story in case I don't get around to it, and then we'll talk a little bit about the literature. And my intention is not so much to say anything that practical, although that which was usually my intention is to say something practical, right? Because what's the point of all this if it isn't useful to us? But it's also helpful sometimes to take a little step back and just investigate these treasures that we've received and try to get sort of a new angle on them. And even though it's all written down and it's all on the internet and published and so on, in a way it's all kind of secret teachings. And it really does seem to help to have heard about this stuff from somebody else. There's kind of a oral tradition that continues, you know. So I don't know if this particular half hour will change your life around koans, but maybe just a sort of help with a gradual familiarization with this strange literature and just getting a little more comfortable with it and a little more curious about it, which has been kind of my path. My teacher gave a talk on every case in this 100 case collection at one point, sort of early 90s, I think, set that task for himself, and I was there for a lot of them. And at the time, sometimes I enjoyed hearing about them, and sometimes I thought they were kind of annoying. And couldn't he just say something practical? But, you know, now lately I've been coming back to these stories, and I've been surprising myself with how interesting they are, and how relevant, and how they have a kind of a feeling about life baked into them. Which is really, I think, more and more what practice is about. There's a kind of a feeling about life that gradually dawns on us. We've surrounded it with all kinds of dramatic language, you know, like the very problematic term, enlightenment. But actually, in the end, there's a kind of a depth of feeling that is what emerges over time with practice, don't you think? Yeah, and then you see, sometimes you see that in your colleagues, or you think you're not seeing it, your colleagues, little more than you see it in yourself, you know. So anyway, here's the story. It's about a master named Jingjing, who lived in the 9th into the 10th century in China. Jingjing asked a monk, "What sound is that outside the gate?" The monk said, "The sound of raindrops." Jing said, "Sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things." The monk said, "What about you, teacher?" Jing said, "I almost don't lose myself." The monk said, "What is the meaning of I almost don't lose myself?" Jing said, "Though it still should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult. Has to be difficult." So this is a typical kind of story, I think, in this literature. A dialogue, an exchange, a meeting. All these stories, one way or the other, about meeting, you know. And we could think about like a student and a teacher meeting, which just seems to be the narrative structure usually. We could also think about it like meeting ourselves, meeting different voices and understandings and views within ourselves. And about meeting the world, meeting the environment. And so not to be afraid to start with just the obvious narrative elements of these stories. We don't have to immediately try to distill them down to some sort of pure enlightenment elixir. The commentary by the collector of these stories, or actually the commentarier on the collector of these stories, is a very strange text. There's multiple layers of teachers writing, and it's not really distinguished who's saying what. But anyway, the commentator named Yuan Wu tells us that Jingjing always asks this question: was the sound outside the gate? And this is a great trope in Zen. To have a single device for teaching, a single thing that you bring up over and over and over again, and a single practice to meet your life with. Like Zazen, right? A single practice. There's no like advanced Zazen you learn later, right? It's just Zazen, right? Just sitting, just being. And so this teacher, this was his question. He would ask, "What is the sound outside the gate?" Well, how about hearing that very literally? What do you hear? What is around you? The traffic, the chickens, the other native birds. To open to the world around us. To have our relationship be one of awareness and fluidity, and allowing. Not to be walled off in some little version of me, so busy with my thoughts and concerns that I don't even notice the sounds around me. And of course, sound is just one of many vectors by which the world interacts with us, you know, and invites us forward, but we miss it so often, you know. So I wanted to congratulate you on your purchase of land. Well, the first thing I said to Koshin was, "I want to, you know, commiserate. I'm really sorry. You know? Too bad. Whoops. Now life gets more complicated." And I wished I could have been there for the dedication ceremony, but that was the weekend of our annual one of our annual hiking retreats. We go to the edge of Mount Baker. And, you know, all the Zen temples of yore were always on mountains. So we go and have a mountain zendo. And the place we go on the edge of Mount Baker, actually there's like a little forest horse packers shelter, a little open shelter. So we make a little zendo there. So that's where I was that weekend. And I was thinking about the first time, or maybe the second, but one of the early times that we did this hike. We hike in silence. It takes like, you know, 8-10 hours to hike in. It's 8 miles. We stop along the sides of the trail and do little rituals, little Zen rituals like you do here. And on the way back, You know, days later on the way back, I noticed along the trail all these little teeny hemlock seedlings. And to my subjective self, those had not been there before. Where did these come from? But of course they must have been there, you know. They seemed like they were more than 3 days in existence, you know. So I just hadn't even seen them. Despite all the supports of being like so-called the teacher is one problem to have to. And but also, you know, the silence and the meditation we do, hadn't seen these hundreds and hundreds of hemlock seedlings. I must have walked right by them and stepped right on top of them. Didn't see them. So these stories are also encouragement to be open, you know, to be aware. Literally, what is the sound outside the gate? What do you hear? Yuan Yu says, here are some of the other times he asked that. One time he asked that, and the monk said, the sound of quail, to which the teacher responded, if you wish to avoid uninterrupted hell, don't slander the wheel of the true teachings. So he didn't approve of that answer. It wasn't just the sound of the quail. Another time the monk responded, the sound of a snake eating a frog. That's what I hear, teacher. And the teacher said, I knew that sentient beings suffer. Here is a suffering sentient being. So these stories also, of course, are famous as kind of testing, you know. And in the early transmission of Zen to the West in the 50s and 60s, that really got emphasized. These stories were explained as ways to, like, short-circuit the intellect and take people to some special rarefied level. And they're not that. But it's not right to say that they're just puzzles or problems. I've had the good fortune to do a little bit of that sort of intensive, kind of introspective sitting with the central part of the koan in Zazen. And one of the things I learned is that the intellect is very much there. But it's just meeting the story and meeting your life and meeting your practice in a little different way, deeper, if you will. So the teacher's literally asking, what do you hear? But also asking the monks, how do you understand this being here, this being alive, this being one who can listen? Is it just the sound that you put words to? Is it just the concept that you build in your head of a chicken or a raindrop or a snake eating a frog? And I think the other implied joke there is that snakes are silent. You know, you can't really hear them from inside the temple, you know. And yet, is that the only way of hearing? Another koan says, if you want to understand hearing, you should hear with your eyes and see with your ears. So there is a challenge here, isn't there? But it's not a challenge to figure something out. It's a challenge to have a broader understanding than our usual simplified shorthand, where we look around and we listen and we say, oh, a car, a ferry, a person, my wife, you know. I know what those are. I can go on with my own egotistical existence, you know, unhampered by any questions, you know, because I know what everything is, right? So these koan stories encourage us to take another look, another listen, and to be grateful to our teachers for not saying, oh yeah, sure, yeah, just a raindrop. What is it really? What is it? So the interesting thing about this particular example of Ching Ching's method, asking this question, is even though in this case he also gave the student a hard time, he responded to the monk's answer, the sound of raindrops, by saying, sentient beings are inverted or upside down, just like that line in the Heart Sutra. They lose themselves and follow after things. So this is really literally true, isn't it? We lose ourselves. We lose track of our intentions. We forget about our best selves. We're constantly following after things, right? This whole society is built on how profitable it is to get people following after things. And we are in there with everybody, you know. So the monk doesn't just bow and withdraw. So there's also the great thing in these stories is these examples of courage and vulnerability. At first I heard these stories as kind of harsh, but now I see them as very loving, actually. Very permissive. In this monastery, it was okay to say, I don't understand. To stand before the teacher and say, well, how do you understand it? He says, the way it's translated is, well, what about you, teacher? And Ai Ching's answer is really interesting. I almost don't lose myself. So a moment ago, he's accusing the monk and everybody else of losing themselves. And when asked about his practice, his attainment, he says, I almost don't lose myself. Does not give any tips or tricks or hints about his complete awakening. But he embraces almost there. So I was a bit of a striver in the practice when I was younger. I would lay good odds, your dear Koshin was too. And one of the rakusu I received from my teacher, Norman, he wrote on there in great big letters, even Buddha only halfway there. So I think of that, even Buddha only halfway there. What is this idea we have of finishing things? Does that actually make any sense? Are we ever all the way there? Are we ever never losing ourselves? Or is it an endless process of remembering and forgetting, losing ourselves and finding ourselves? I mean, almost is not good enough, but almost is perfect, you know? Almost there is just right. Another way to look at that, of course, is with the great, wonderful archetype of the Bodhisattva, right? That's what they say about the Bodhisattva. If the Bodhisattva could flip off into ultimate nirvana and leave all this trouble behind. But she looks around and says, no way. Beings are suffering in this mixed up world. I gotta stick around and try to help. Almost don't lose myself. So I'm here to practice with you, dear monks, you know, to try to help you as I continue to try to understand. And the commentator of the collection is very critical that the monk doesn't shut up now, actually. He asks a follow-up to the follow-up, you know. He says, well, what does that mean? What is the meaning of I almost don't lose myself? You know, which is kind of like saying, how can I totally lose myself in this teaching, almost don't lose yourself? How can I use this beautiful example of letting go to try to attain something, right? So the teacher lays it on a little thicker. He says, though it still should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult. So the Buddha wasn't messing around when he formulated these truths about suffering, right? Life has to be difficult. We have probably all given our life, we've all made the attempt, I'm sure, to create a life that is not difficult. We have given it the old college try, right? And we're among the privileged, actually, so we had a lot of resources to do this. So if we couldn't do it, you know, probably nobody can do it, you know. And we certainly see how much the super rich suffer. It's hard to be sympathetic sometimes, right? But people with unlimited resources can't do it. The whole thing has to be difficult. So that's case 46 of the Blue Cliff Record, Changing Sound of Raindrops. Do I have any more time, Cushing Song?
Yeah, you got 5 minutes.
5 minutes! Cool. So a few more general points about these stories. One thing is that you can really kind of hear them like family stories, you know. And like all family stories, they get modified and morphed and exaggerated over the years, you know. Like this, what Uncle Ralph did at Thanksgiving that year, you know, 50 years ago, probably didn't do that. And yet family stories are treasures, right? They're how we understand our family, and thus how we understand ourselves. And the enthusiastic presentation of these stories as examples of true enlightenment, that's also true, I think. But the thing is, so is the call of the rooster, right? So is the sunrise. So is the fact that human beings can build automobiles. These are also expressions of enlightenment. So is language, you know. Everything is an expression of enlightenment. But these are kind of wrapped up in little pith short stories, so we can kind of hold them up and look at them. So that's helpful to us. And their foreignness is helpful to us, I think, if we're not too put off by it, nor too enamored by it. So these are wonderful stories, but I think not to be too in love with them, and not to be too fearful or annoyed or pushing them away. These are our treasures that we have somehow received. We receive them kind of a roundabout way. We receive them through Japanese teachers reading Chinese texts, and the Japanese have a different way of reading the Chinese that the Chinese would never recognize. And then coming to America and trying to explain it to us, you know, partly because they saw this little light on understanding, and partly sometimes to show off, you know. So it's we receive these through many layers of history and culture and language. The names are hard because there's two different versions of the Chinese transliteration into English, you know. And then there's the way the Japanese said them. Now more and more we're taking we're trying to do our bad, you know, a rough approximation of the Chinese pronunciation because it seems weird to say Japanese words for a Chinese person. But the way we pronounce them is wrong anyway. And they have problems too. These are stories of old guys, 99% of the time. They're patriarchal and male and misogynist. Luckily, there are some recent attempts to unearth the stories of the enlightened women in our family. Probably the best one so far is called The Hidden Lamp, which I think probably you've heard of, edited by Sue Moon and Florence Kaplow, and including short essays by contemporary women teachers. So it's a wonderful, wonderful book, The Hidden Lamp. You can thank Sue and Florence for creating that. And that the books have very odd structures, so you got to kind of read the introduction and try to unpack who wrote what here, you know. This particular one's extra weird, where one teacher one, named Juedo, collected the stories and wrote a verse about each one. And this is in very dense blocks of Chinese with no punctuation. Teacher 2, like 160 to 100 years later, gave Dharma talks in every one, and he put little, like, small characters in between the big characters, little comments. And then all that gets translated into English, and sometimes they use footnotes, sometimes they use italics, you know. And of course, Chinese had neither footnotes nor italics. So it takes a little persistence to unpack these. This teacher appeared in one other story, so maybe I'll close with the second story by Qing Jing and see if you have any thoughts or disagreements. Because partly the way these came to us, we have many Zen students have strong opinions about what they are or aren't. So if I was sacrilegious or problematic, I apologize. Here's the second story about Qing Jing and his monk buddies, Pao Fu and Chang Qing. So don't mix up Qing Jing and Chang Qing. Once when Pao Fu and Chang Qing were wandering in the mountains, Pao Fu pointed with his hand and said, "Right here." Wait, pointed with his hand or to his hand? Yeah, pointed with his hand and said, "Right here is the summit of the mystic peak." Chang Qing said, "Indeed, what a pity." Their teacher back at the monastery, Shuedo, added a word saying, "Today, what is the purpose of traveling in the mountains together with these fellows? Hundreds of years hence, I don't say there are none, just that there will be few." And even later, Qing Jing was quoted as saying, "If I had been there, Pao Fu, you would have seen the skulls covering the fields." So anyway, if I had more time, we'd unpack that a little bit, but I was trying to bring up the playfulness of the stuff. These guys were going hiking on a day off, continuing to make Zen jokes and try to one-up each other And somebody went back to the monastery and told the teacher, "Did you hear what Pavlov said?" If I had been there, then you would have understood. So, thank you for listening so patiently to that little meandering talk about Master Qingjing of old, you know. It's also kind of a golden ages system. So this is like the golden ages in 9th, 10th, 11th century. And of course, stuff happened since then, but that's not in the storyline. Like the Brothers Grimm, you know. So like the Brothers Grimm. Well, what do you think? Or the way they'd say it in here, speak! It's a good Zen answer. Qingjing might approve. He might not. There are a lot of them, too, that are about imitation, you know. It's no good to just imitate the teacher. Bad stuff happens if you just imitate the teacher in these stories. You have to find your own way of expressing whatever this is, this dharma, this feeling.
I have a cramp in my leg.
Why didn't you move it?
I did. It still is a cramp.
Unpleasant.
That stick. What do you do with that stick?
30 blows. in our tradition, when we're teaching, we always carry the Dharma staff, and I think the symbolism that just comes like from the royal scepter, you know, it's the staff of the Dharma kings.
Beautiful.
Yeah. I had one before, but I broke it. Probably means I have many years or lifetimes to. Yeah. And then the other thing about these stories, too, is they're also borrowing from Chinese legal language, and these are like seen. So the word koan means legal case, actually. Mm-hmm. So they're seen as like precedents. And so there is a lot of language of violence. I was going to spend another few minutes on that, but. So you can hear it as also allegorical and citing the punishments from the Chinese legal system. One of them must have been 30 blows, because that comes up a lot. And I don't think the teacher actually whacked the student 30 times. I don't think so. But who knows? You know, we weren't there.
What kind of gates is he talking about?
Sorry?
What kind of gates is he talking about?
Oh, it's talking about like at the typical monastery, there's a big gate out front, which usually the doors are just left open all the time. So he's just talking about out there, out beyond the monastery, outside. Like I think symbolically, he's talking about outside the gate means outside of our immediate sort of subjective experience, right? And one of the ways they talk about gates is the senses are like the gates, you know, things come inside and out of. So we're kind of like each of us lost in our own little busy monastery where all these things are happening. What do I have to do? Blah 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 blah. So what's outside? What's beyond that? What's beyond our subjective life? Yeah. How did you hear it outside the gate?
Well, I wondered whether or not it was literal or not, inside and outside.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can hear the rain inside and outside.
Oh, very good. Yeah, exactly. Well, it's usually both and neither, you know. Literal and not literal and not literal. Yeah.
How would you answer Qingjing's question?
Oh. What do you hear outside the gate? I think today I would have just begged his forgiveness because I don't have an answer. How would you?
Drip. Drop. Drip. Drop.
Plop. Thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at SZC.org.